Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Nothing seems more calculated to put a smile on the face of a nation than a tremendous haul of Olympic medals. As we are recording this episode of The Rest is History on the modern Olympics, Britain is rejoicing at the news that we have podiumed in a range of sports: swimming, diving, cross-country, mountain biking, and perhaps by the time you listen to this, there will be even more. And of course, this, for anyone who lived through it, cannot help but remind us of 9 years ago and the wonderful 2 weeks at London 2012, when the enthusiasm of journalists and columnists went off the scale. And it's mentioned in a wonderful book I've been reading, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, by David Goldblatt. And he's looking at the press coverage, and he cites a columnist who was writing in the Daily Mail who stands proxy, David Goldblatt writes, albeit at the more florid end of the scale, for much of the commentary from both left and right. And this columnist from the Daily Mail, who stands at the more florid end of the scale, wrote, even for people who detest sport, the past 2 weeks have been a patriotic extravaganza with few parallels in our recent history. And I think that regular listeners to The Rest is History will know who David Goldblatt is talking about here, who this columnist for the Daily Mail might be, Dominic Sandbrook.
Tom, I thought that was going to be embarrassing, but then you used the word podiumed, and I realised that actually I've come out of that much better than I thought.
I'm obsessed by verbing. I think it was 2012, wasn't it, that it all kicked off and people talked about
meddling.
I cannot stop doing it. Anyway, so I'm guessing from that, you're at the more florid end of enthusiasm for Olympic mania, that you're a big fan.
No, that was a good example. About a week before the Olympics began, I'd written a column saying I hated the Olympics and it was all going to be a disaster. And then in traditional columnist fashion,
you swung around.
10 days later, I was miraculously converted to the joys of the Olympics. Actually, I'm quite an Olympic skeptic. I genuinely wouldn't be bothered if the Olympics were abandoned. And of course, I celebrate British medals as much as anybody. But I think, as we will discover, the history of the Olympics. I mean, we did the history of the ancient Olympics last time, and that was a pretty gory business. The history of the modern Olympics is also a pretty gory business, I think, though in a different way.
But from the historian's point of view, they're brilliant, aren't they? Because they're a kind of 4-yearly temperature check.
Absolutely.
On the state of culture, global politics, whatever, which just makes them fantastic. I mean, and until I read David Goldblatt's book, which I didn't really know much about the Olympics, the modern Olympics. But it's such a fascinating topic. And actually, I kind of fell down any number of rabbit holes looking at the beginnings of the Olympics.
Yeah, and actually, if you go through
because
it,
because they are so interesting.
They are.
The stories around them are so peculiar. But Dominic, you when we talk about the absolute beginnings of the modern Olympics.
Yes.
I mean, this is very much your patch, isn't it? Because basically, it's a kind of Cotswold Shropshire story.
It is. So the very first, we'll get to Shropshire in a minute, because I think Shropshire is where the Olympics really began, the modern Olympics. But there's an antecedent, which is, of course, the Cotswold Olympics, which I'm sure you know about, set up by a man called Robert Dover in 1612 in Chipping Campden. In basically the most, the Hollywood sort of quintessence of Englishness, isn't it, Chipping Campden? Sort of arts and crafts movement, bucolic, pastoral idyll. And he set it up. It's unclear why he set it up. Some people think it's because it's to do with the defence of the realm and manly virtues. And others say it's about it's something at a time of great uncertainty and sort of political unrest.
Isn't it kind of also he's Catholic?
I think something like
very
that.
Yes. Anglo-Catholic.
Yeah.
So isn't it also about kind of Maypoles and Merry England?
I think there is a lot of that. Yes.
A lot of kind of frolicking.
Well, the sports
as the Puritans are gearing up to ban it.
Exactly. The sports are very Merry England: sledgehammer throwing, fighting with cudgels. Shin kicking, which they still do. And my favourite sport. Are you an aficionado of Dwyer flonking, Tom?
We talk of little else in the Holland household. So, of course, I'm a great fan, but just remind me what it is.
Do you want me to remind you of the rules?
Yes.
I'll remind you of the rules. So, a dull-witted person is chosen as the referee, or jobber owl. The two teams decide who will flonk first by tossing a sugar beet.
What is flonking?
Well, I'm going to explain. The game begins when the jobber owl shouts, "Here you go together." The non-flonking team join hands and dance in a circle around a member of the flonking team, a practice known as girting. The flonker dips his dwile-tipped driveler into a bucket of beer, then spins around in the opposite direction to the girters and flonks his dwile at them. If the dwile misses completely, it is known as a swodge.
Naturally. What else would it be called?
When this happens, the flonker must drink the contents
control yourself.
The flonker must drink the contents of an of an ale-filled gazunder before the wet dwile has passed from hand to hand along the lines of now non-girting girters chanting the ceremonial mantra of pot, pot, pot. So that's dwile flonking, and I believe it was invented actually in East Anglia and has moved to the Cotswold Olympics and the Cotswold Olympics.
So why is that not on Sky Sport?
Well, this is the thing. Why don't they do that at the Olympics? I mean, they do football, and that's a complete joke at the Olympics. They do basketball, which is also a joke.
I like the idea that the ref has to be a village idiot.
Yes, a dull-witted... the jobber owl, I think. Yes. Is the, anyway...
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
So they do these kind... I mean, obviously, that the Cotswold Olympics, which still continues, has now become a bit of a sort of... it's become a self-conscious kind of joke. But obviously, the interesting thing to me about this is that that's 1612. They didn't do the dwarf flunking in 1612, by the way. That's a more recent innovation. But obviously, there was a buried memory, wasn't there? Of the ancient Olympics, I suppose.
It gets recaptured with the Renaissance.
Yeah, Hellenophiles.
So Shakespeare starts to talk about kind of Olympian contests and so on. Milton talks about Satan as being like an Olympian runner.
Does he?
Yeah, which of course, Milton is writing is very much from the Puritan end of things. And so it's not surprising that with the Civil War and the Protectorate, that gets banned, right? I think.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That there's a lot of there's distrust of sport because I suppose organized sport is seen as it's exactly what we were talking about before, isn't it? That it's they are much closer to that sense of sport as religious, as part of a religious festival.
Clearly they have absolutely no idea at all about what the ancient Olympics actually involved. And I guess that as you go through the 18th into the 19th century, people do start to have a better sense of that. So 1794, apparently there was a chariot race at Newmarket between Nanny Hodges and Lady Ladds for 500 guineas. And the Times said that it was something like a revival of the Olympic Games.
Right. That's interesting. And didn't the French revolutionaries?
Yeah, Danton was a big fan.
Big fan of the Olympics. They used metric measures. First time metric measures were used in sport. Shameful moment.
And then of course you've got Greece. So when Greece becomes independent from the Ottomans,
1821. There are
kind of calls from poets and nationalists and so on to reinstate the Olympic Games, and they do have in 1859, they hold what are called Olympic Games for over 3 Sundays in Athens. And they have running, they have horse and chariot races, they have discus, javelin, and they have the climbing of a greasy pole.
So Benjamin Disraeli could participate, yes, in that, and, yeah, and would do very well. I mean, he'd have been there, perfect timing for him. So at those games, they have prize money donated from a small town in the Midlands of England called Muchwenlock. And
the ones in Greece?
Yes. Oh, the people of Muchwenlock, right, send money to those games in Greece. Now, why? Well, this brings us to the true birthplace of the Olympic movement, which is the Shropshire market town of Muchwenlock, where my parents lived for the best part of 15 years.
You must be so proud.
I'm very proud. And it's a very big deal in Muchwenlock. So one of the London 2012 mascots was called Wenlock. There were two, Wenlock and Mandeville. Mandeville, Stoke Mandeville being the birthplace of the Paralympics. Muchwenlock, the birthplace of the Summer Games. And they have a little museum in Muchwenlock, and you can walk around. There's an Olympic Trail, all these sort of things. So genuine, you know, this is not just Shropshire chauvinism on my part. There's a genuine historical reality here. And basically, the guy who started it is a man called, a fascinating man called William Penny Brooks, who's a classic Victorian kind of do-gooding reformer. So he sets up things like an agricultural reading society. And he has this series of what he calls classes to do different things in the town. And in 1850, he sets up the Olympian class. I mean, this is pure, I think Goldblatt talks about this in his book. And it absolutely gives you a sense of the Victorian mindset at the heart of the Olympic movement. Because the rubric of the Olympian class says it's set up for the promotion of the moral, physical and intellectual improvement of the inhabitants of the town and neighbourhood of Muchwenlock, and especially of the working classes, by the encouragement of outdoor recreation and the award of prizes annually at annual meetings for skill in athletic exercise and proficiency in intellectual and industrial attainments. So there you have pure kind of Victorian improvement. And they hold it at a local race course. They have some brilliant events at the first Wenlock Games. So they have football, cricket, they have quoits, running, cycling on penny farthings, a blindfolded wheelbarrow race, and my favourite event, one that stands comparison, I think, with Dwyer flunking, an old women's race, with the prize being a pound of tea. Again, something I'd like to see at the modern Olympics.
I think there's so race. Much scope for innovation there, isn't there?
And well, they still
it's
do
a
it.
A shame that they've all kind of fallen away. No, but I mean from the proper Olympics. And talking
the proper Olympics is so dull, isn't it?
Well,
so
the proper
dull,
Olympics. Because the way that this influences what comes to be what we now think of as the Olympics is because Baron de Coubertin comes and he's tremendously impressed.
So he goes in 1890. He goes to Shropshire. Now, this is fascinating. Coubertin, I mean, I'm sure you've got lots of stuff about Coubertin. I think he's a fascinating guy. He's the son of a royalist, isn't he? Mm-hmm. French royalist painter. And basically, I think what's absolutely central to this is the Franco-Prussian War. So he's grown up in the aftermath of the Franco-Prussian War. France has been humiliated. And all the talk is of, you know, manliness, unity. France is so divided, of course, in the last years of the 19th century. And he becomes obsessed with Tom Brown's School Days.
Yes, he loved it, didn't he?
Because he loves it.
Because that's the fascinating thing. The inspiration for the Olympics is only very dimly kind of the Hellenic Games, the original Games. I mean, it is important to Coubertin. I mean, he does have a sense of that kind of the spiritual dimension that the Games had for the Greeks.
Yeah.
But really, the influence on him, as you say, I mean, it's the kind of Victorian manliness and...
It absolutely... He believes... And the fascinating thing is, actually, he's got it wrong. He thinks Thomas Arnold, the headmaster of rugby, was all about sport and muscular Christianity. And he puts a huge emphasis on this. But actually... Dr. Arnold wasn't that interested in sport.
But it's Tom Brown's School Days.
He's
right?
confused Tom Brown's School Days with reality. So Coubertin has read this Tom Brown's School Days. He believes that at rugby, men were taught to be men and all this sort of stuff. And so he comes up to Shropshire on this pilgrimage because he thinks this is... And he sees all the old women in wheelbarrows and stuff. And he says, brilliant, this is how we'll beat the Prussians. next time, you know, because we've been doing quoits, we will be prepared. And so he then, so I think it's only 6 years. He does it very quickly.
I mean, it's not just about kind of preparing for war with the Prussians, though, is it? Because he's actually very into the ideal of internationalism.
Yes, he is.
Because when he gives his famous speech in 1892, calling for the Olympics to be revived, let us export rowers, runners and fencers. There is the free trade of the future. And the day it is introduced within the walls of old Europe, the cause of peace will have received a new and mighty stay.
Yeah, yeah, so that's fair. I'm being hard on him.
So that actually, I mean, that it's kind of internationalist talk of peace.
Yes.
That, I guess, provides to the modern Olympics what the much stranger kind of spirit that involves sacrificing 100 oxen to Zeus supplied to the ancients.
But isn't it weird though, Tom? You're absolutely right, and I think that spirit, it's very kind of late 19th century globalization, isn't it? And sort of a descendant of the liberal free trade, free ideas, all that sort of stuff that was so popular in the mid-19th century. But it has so little in common with the ancient Olympics.
Yeah, very little.
I mean, basically, they take the name, they take the torch, and they take some of the iconography.
But the iconography grows up over
a long time. Yes, it does. Yeah. Exactly.
So it's not there immediately. And I mean, there are kind of, it's structured around patent fantasies. So there's the idea that it will always be above politics, that it has nothing to do with politics.
Yeah, which,
and
as
right
you say,
from the beginning, that's mad.
It is mad. And actually, I'm sure you noticed this, swatting up for this podcast, decided that this is an incredibly political story from the beginning.
Whole way
and this
through.
Sort of,
and that's, yeah, the fascination,
and there's never
of
a moment, there's never a moment ever, there's never been a moment where the Olympics has been separate from politics.
But also, this kind of ideal of the amateur, which he is picking up from Tom Brown's school days and, you know, British public schools and stiff upper lips and things, that this is a practical way of organizing sport in an increasingly industrialized mass entertainment era. I mean, and that lasts kind of pretty, I mean, it lasts for decades, doesn't it? I mean,
it does.
Takes
it lasts
a long time
to the sort of mid to late 20th century, exactly.
Yeah.
So you're right, because of course, professional sport already exists. So, you know,
yes.
Particularly,
which is why the British are not particularly interested in the Olympics.
Yeah, because it's backward. It's sort of pointless. It's sort of like, you know, when we already have so many professional sports, and when we're living in a world of W.G. Grace and, you know, the Football League and Rugby League and all these things, the idea of the Olympics just seems ridiculously old-fashioned, even in the 1890s, I think.
And it's a bit French, isn't it?
It is a bit French. But it's so interesting that with all these sporting things, it's the British that kind of have the original idea, but it takes the French to codify them. This is true of football as well, FIFA, and you know, it often takes continental Europeans. I think because the British were there first, they generally are just happy to.
Although, you know, Dominic, I mean, a reassuring note from a cricketing point of view is
French.
That someone who has joined the IOC, so the initial committee, was actually the captain of the New Zealand cricket team.
So right?
Steady hand on the tiller there.
Has cricket ever been played at the Olympics?
Yes, it's played in the second Olympiad, 1900.
Yeah.
Held in Paris, where there was one match, and it was England against France. Britain was represented by a team of strolling players from Devon and Somerset, and France was represented by British expats in Paris.
Right.
And I'm proud to say that Britain won. But France got the silver medal. So France is a silver medalist.
Is
the current silver medalist in cricket. Which is a wonderful detail.
That's a lot. Our listeners in Dijon will be delighted by that, won't they?
I mean, yeah, I hope so.
I know we're very popular in France.
Dominic, of course. Paris is the second one, but the first one is held where else? In Athens.
Yes.
So it's kind of interesting. They never think to hold it actually in Olympia. I think the Olympia scene is a bit of a disappointment. There's not actually, it takes a long time to excavate, so there isn't very much there. Whereas Athens, I guess, is kind of more suitable.
But also, Athens is the capital, isn't it, of the newly independent, or relatively newly independent Greece. So it's tied up with ideas of national, you know, must have been tied up with enormous ideas about Greek national pride and so on.
I think, and I may not have this entirely, but I think the games open on Greek Independence Day.
Right.
And of course, the great innovative race is the marathon.
Yeah.
Which they run from the grave of the Persians on the plain of Marathon, where the Athenians had defeated Persia. And then the news is supposed, you know, the story goes that the news is brought to Athens by Pheidippides, who then collapses as he delivers it. And so they restage this race running from the tomb of the Persians all the way into Athens, and it's won by a Greek.
And actually, of course, this is not an event that they did at the Olympics, right?
No,
the
ancient Olympics. So it's a complete innovation, but it's a tremendous success. And I think that because it's won by a Greek, Greece becomes terribly enthusiastic about it as a result, and they're very keen to stage it permanently in Athens. I think it has a kind of, you know, it genuinely is gloriously amateur. So there's a guy who's there on holiday who enters the tennis and kind of wins the gold. And there's a brilliant thing about the swimming that, you know, they don't have a pool. So they hold it in Piraeus Harbour. And it's unseasonably cold.
Right.
So people jump in to do the swimming event, and it's so cold that lots of them get back out again. and actually, problems with swimming events is a theme of the early Olympics. So in Paris in 1900, they hold it in the Seine, and the currents are so strong there that your medal chances depend on whether you can catch the right current or not.
That's great.
And at St. Louis in 1904... two of the gold medal winning US water polo team die 6 months after the event because they've contracted typhoid from the lagoon in which the water polo had been played.
Well, pay a high price for elite sporting achievement.
You really do. But I think that the sense of kind of shambolic amateurism that is a kind of, you know, it's a quality of the first games in Athens is it's the one in Paris that absolutely exemplifies it.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that it's piggybacking onto the World Exhibition that is being held in Paris.
Isn't that the case with a lot of these early Olympics?
Yes.
They're basically all arranged around
same
trade
with St. Louis. Yes. Yeah. And actually, you know, so that goes back to Crystal Palace and the Great Exhibition.
Yeah.
This idea that you have a great gathering of people from across the world and you showcase your city and your country.
William Penny Brooks's thing at Watch Wenlock, see, bringing it back to Shropshire, was that prizes would also be awarded for proficiency in intellectual and industrial attainments. So that's that's a year before the Great Exhibition. So it's very much that Victorian sort of spirit that, as you say, the trade fairs, therefore, are not an illegitimate, you know, they're part of the essence from the beginning. And that's something that
absolutely. I think they structure the whole idea of the Olympics as we understand it now. I mean, that's a crucial part of it. And part of the problem for Coubertin and the Olympic movement is that people are going to Paris for the trade fair and they have no idea that the Olympics are going on. And so there's this kind of wonderful, probably my favorite Olympian of all time is an American woman called Margaret Abbott, who is in Paris studying with Degas, with Rodin. She's an artist.
Yeah,
and she gets told, "Yeah, there's this golf contest going on. Would you like to enter it?" And she, yeah, okay, great. So she enters the golf. She wins. She has no idea that she's won gold in the golf contest. She is America's first female gold medal winner, and she dies in 1955. And people still don't know. So she dies never knowing that she's been an Olympic gold medalist. And I think it's only kind of in the 70s or 80s when historians of the Olympics go through and work this out that she gets enshrined in this role, which, you know, kind of brilliantly shows how shambolic the whole affair is. The other kind of very haunting story from the Paris Olympics is that the Dutch rowing team, they don't have a cox. I think the cox falls ill or something. And so they scoop a French boy who's about 10, you know, off one of the canals or something, and he coxes them. And I think they win. They get the gold medal, but nobody knows who this boy is.
He's the only
gold medal winning Olympian who is anonymous. So that's great stuff, isn't it?
Did he know he'd won? Did he even know himself what he was doing? Just some blokes had put him on a boat and said,
"Not sure." Don't know.
Wow.
So all good stuff. But the greatest race of all time is the marathon that was raced in St. Louis
in 1904.
And so I think we should have a break, shouldn't we?
Absolutely, and we should have a break.
I'm going to come back. Can I tell you about that? Because I think it's
tell me at great length, because I know you
so
love this story.
Brilliant. And then basically my knowledge of the Olympics is exhausted. And I'll hand the baton over to you.
I do not believe that's true. All right, we'll take a break and we'll come back for the greatest marathon of all time.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom Holland has made great claims for his marathon story. I am so looking forward to hearing it. Tom, please do it justice.
Well, they made Chariots of Fire, but honestly, if you were making a film, this is the race that you'd want to do. I think it's the greatest race in Olympics history. Raced it in 1904 at St. Louis, which is very hot, very sticky, very dusty. And the organisers... They make the marathon along a route where there is, I think, a single water cooler 12 miles into the race. But otherwise, there is no source of water.
And is it 26 because miles at this point?
There are scientists want to measure the effects of dehydration on elite athletes. Okay. So that's the context. So that's part of the fun.
Nice.
So I will describe some of the contestants who the positions where they run. So the guy who comes in first is a guy called Fred Lortz, who is a bricklayer and a notorious practical joker. He is awarded the gold medal, and it then turns out that he's hitched 9 mile lift on the back of a truck. So he gets stripped of his medal and he says, I'll just have a laugh. Yeah. So the next person who comes in, who then is in line for winning the medal, is a guy called Thomas Hicks, who is a professional, you know, he's a seasoned marathon runner. He has a coach who can see that Hicks is flagging, so gives him an elite sports drink. So kind of, you know, the equivalent of a nice Lucozade. Sports drink. Lucozade. But do you know what it consists of? It consists of egg whites, brandy, and strychnine.
Oh, my God. I didn't expect the strychnine.
No. So he's staggering towards the final post. He gets his kind of great glug of strychnine and he starts to go delirious and starts kind of wandering off all the wrong way. So he has to be guided towards the finish line, and people have to literally, you know, his helpers have to literally lift his feet up, because by this point he's absolutely out of it. So he wins. He is the medal winner. Coming in number four is a Cuban postman called Felix Carvajal.
Right.
Who's in Cuba. He runs up and down Cuba. That's what he does for fun. And he hitches a lift on a boat from Cuba to America. He loses all his money gambling. So he turns up at St. Louis. He doesn't have any cash to buy running gear. So he comes to the start of the race in his brogues, in his kind of thick, heavy trousers. He's got a beret on. He's got a baggy white shirt. I mean, he couldn't be less well equipped to run it. One of the other contenders takes pity on him and chops off the bottoms of his trousers so that he's kind of wearing running shorts by this point. He sets off. He stops at various points to he nicks, I think, some apricots from a tree.
Is that an artificial stimulant? Surely not.
He eats some apples that are raw, so he gets upset. He's stopping the whole way to kind of chat with people, but he comes in fourth.
Yeah.
So that's a great feat.
Incredible achievement.
But the in a way the most credible achievement of all is a guy called Len Tao.
Len Tao.
He comes from South Africa, or to be specific, from a tribe in South Africa. And he is there as part of probably the most sinister aspect of these international fairs.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
So they had this in Paris and they have it in St. Louis.
Is it the Department of Anthropology have set this up?
Yeah. It's human zoos. So they had it. They have this in Paris. And they have it in St. Louis. They bring people over from various parts of the colonial empire. And in America, they bring Native Americans over as well. And they kind of put them up in villages. And what they do in St. Louis is they have this idea that they want to measure the athletic capacity of people they see as inferior. So it's, I think, the kind of the press in America call them the Savage Olympics. And they get all these guys from out of the human zoos, and they, you know, these people have never done weightlifting or, you know, anything, and they're made to compete, and they don't do very well, and so this is taken as proof that white people are more proficient at athletics than everyone else. But Len Tao enters the marathon, and he races barefoot, comes in ninth, but that is all the more creditable because while he's running the marathon, he gets attacked by a dog and has to run an extra mile to escape it.
Wow.
So I think he is my
kind
of...
Yeah, he's the moral victor, isn't he? He's the absolute moral victor. It's a
great achievement.
That is a great achievement. Well, talking of moral victors, you know the marathon in the next Olympics, 1908? There's a great story there about a man called... Do you know about this Durando Pietri, Tom?
No.
So he's a... he's very short. He's 5'2". He's a shop boy, a confectionery shop boy from Italy.
And where is this one being
held? So this is Antwerp, 1908,
Is it Antwerp?
No, it's London.
London. Yes, White City. They build White City.
So he has entered a race in Italy. He saw a race in Italy four years earlier, and he was dressed in his work clothes. He was going to work or something, and he saw the race going by, and he thought he'd join in. And he came and he did really well. I think he won it, actually. So he started to run marathons and stuff. And he trains really hard for the 1908 Olympics. He runs the marathon and it's an incredibly hot day. It's an unseasonably hot day. And he overtakes the leader just before the end. And then they come into the stadium or whatever. And there's a very famous photo. You've probably seen it without knowing it.
Yeah.
He keeps collapsing and the crowd are cheering him on and he's collapsing and he's almost at the line. There are 75,000 people there. I think he falls four times and eventually right at the finish line, he collapses again and the umpires have to lift him up and sort of drag him over the line. And he's disqualified, despite the fact that he's won. So what then happens is Queen Alexandra gives him a gilded silver cup as a reward, you know, to say, you know, well done you. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle writes an article about him, about his heroism, for the Daily Mail. It's a big article in the...
First with the big sports stories.
All the best people have written about the Olympics in the Daily Mail, Tom. So, Arthur Conan Doyle writes about him in the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail readers, with their characteristic generosity, start an appeal for him. They raise the equivalent of £30,000 for this man. And he goes back to Italy and he uses it to open a bakery.
That's a wonderful story.
Isn't that
a nice...
Everybody comes out of that well.
Well, except that, isn't the context of that also a deep strain of British anti-Americanism? Because it's an American, I think, who wins
it is the race.
And there's a lot of kind of American sneering at the decadence of British sport.
So everyone comes out of this well, except the Americans, I think. Maybe should have
yes, maybe. Well, but perhaps. And so that's the context for the London Games.
Yeah.
And then you have Stockholm.
Stockholm, the next one. I sort of lose.
Okay, so Stockholm is important just because that's the first one to be held without reference to a trade fair.
Right, 1912.
So it kind of emancipates itself from that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have the First World War. Yeah. Loads of Olympians die in the war.
And then it's Antwerp.
And then you
Is that right?
Then it's Antwerp, and then it's Paris, right?
So Paris is the Chariots of Fire Games.
Yes. So tell us about that.
Well, I mean...
For those who haven't seen it,
the Chariots of Fire really focuses... David Putnam discovered a book, I think, in 1977, the film producer. He was in Malibu, and he had a cold or something, so he was staying in a borrowed house, and he was really miserable. And he reached for a book off the shelves, and it was the story of the Olympics, I think. I think it was the history of the Olympics. And he... became fixated on the story of the 1924 Games, which has these two iconic British competitors. Harold Abrahams, who is Jewish, who is the son of a Jewish immigrant, who wins the 100 metres, but has raised hackles with the sort of the patrician officials back in Britain because he employs a professional coach, an Italian, Sam Musabini. And the other great athlete who is, you know, will need no introduction is Eric Liddell. The brilliant Scottish runner who refuses to run in the 100 metres heats because they're on a Sunday and he believes that's sacred. So he runs in the 400 metres instead and wins gold. And, you know, if anyone who... Because I'm a sort of sentimental person, I find it hard to watch Chariots of Fire without getting kind of choked up, particularly at completely unironic and sort of sincere treatment of Liddell's religious faith and how important it is to him and how he sees his athletic prowess as a gift from God. And this wonderful story that an American competitor before the race sort of leaves him a note that says, you know, whoever honours me, I will honour. And Liddell uses this as inspiration. And of course, Liddell then goes on, after having won gold and having become a national hero, he goes on to leave athletics completely and to become a missionary in China and ends his days in a Japanese internment camp where he dies just before the end of the war. So he is a genuinely, you know, we do a lot of people with feet of clay in this podcast, but I'm not convinced he did have feet of clay, actually. I think he's a genuinely incredibly admirable and impressive man. So there you go.
Well, there is also in the 1924 Olympics, I think, is the first Irish winner.
Is that
not per se, because the guy who won the tennis in the 1896, so the Athens Games, was Irish, Irish nationalist. At the London Games, there was an Irish competitor who won gold. The Union Jack went up, and he replaced it with the Irish flag. But the first person to win it, as you know, the Free State, was the younger brother of the poet W.B. Yeats, who won silver for painting.
So they were still doing,
yeah.
And they should still do painting, shouldn't they?
And it's interesting because Yeats's brother was he did lots of cartoons for Punch, and he did a strip cartoon parodying Sherlock Holmes. So a kind of, you know, improbable Olympic victor. Yeah. But he apparently he's a very highly rated artist.
I think strip cartoonist. So, I think like Stan Lee should have entered the United States in the 60s or something.
So that's all fun. And then you have Amsterdam, and then you have, in the 30s, you have two games that essentially...
Create the
yeah. Olympics, as we know them. So, and these are chiefly interesting for the fact that my great-uncle competed in them.
Are they chiefly interesting? Are you sure you've chosen your words?
Yeah, they're chiefly interesting for that reason. Chiefly interesting. So my great-uncle, Charles Holland, amazing cyclist, went to LA, came 15th. Then in the 1936 Berlin Olympics came fourth, but he would have come first, except that the foreigners cheated by having gears.
Oh, that is cheating.
And great uncle Charlie, being British, refused to use gears because he viewed it as cheating.
So he's a moral victor, isn't he?
So I'm the great nephew, basically,
of a great Olympian.
You're right. Obviously, there are other aspects of the LA and the Berlin Games. But, you know, LA is the home of Hollywood. Yeah. So,
and Hollywood in its pomp.
And the idea that it's show business. And yeah, absolutely. But and then you have... But it's run on a shoestring because this is the Great Depression and there's
So LA creates the podium, doesn't it? LA, they get, basically, with the Hollywood razzmatazz, they invent the podium. They start playing national anthem. This surprised me because in Chariots of Fire, the film, the playing of the British national anthem is a key moment because it's the moment that Sam Musabini, Harold Abrahams' coach, because he's too nervous to watch the race, so he only knows his man has won when he hears the British national anthem. But I now discover that in 1932, they introduced national anthems for the first time, so this could not have happened. Also, the flame in the cauldron. I mean, that's a very Hollywood touch. And that's Los Angeles. So they didn't do that in the ancient Olympics, Tom. They didn't have an Olympic flame then. Or did they have a torch or anything like that?
No.
That's all utter bilge.
I mean, that's the most famous little known fact about the Olympics, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose so.
That people always bring
up. Not famous to me, clearly.
But the person, you know, the guys who invent the idea of the torch relay from Olympia to the Games is... Nazis.
They're not good guys.
And there's a case for saying that really the template for the modern games as we know them now, you know, it's the most enduring cultural expression of fascism.
Absolutely agree with you. Yeah,
that we have.
I completely agree with you. I think it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it, that people talk about the 1936 games as though they're an anomaly, as though they are the sort of great... Well, I mean, they are a blot on the... They are a stain on the record of the Olympics. But I completely agree with you. They are the moment that the modern Olympics really began.
Yeah.
Because the Nazis and Leni Riefenstahl and the way they are packaged, that creates the template for all subsequent Olympics. And indeed, that sort of, in a way, that the fascism isn't an anomaly because there is a kind of commonality between the sort of the Nazi aesthetic in the 1930s and the sort of Victorian worship of manliness, virility.
But also it's properly, there is a kind of Greek element, an authentically Greek element, with the assumption that what is physically beautiful is morally beautiful.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, that's a very much a kind of fascist idea.
Absolutely, yeah.
That the body beautiful. So the kind of, you know, the famous image in the film of the classical statue of the discus thrower becoming living flesh. That's what the essence, you know, of those 36, the 1936 games is, and all the kind of Hellenic flummery that they throw in. So the torch race, the significance of that is that the Nazis are casting themselves as the kin of the Aryan Greeks who had set up the Olympics. And when the torch comes into, first enters the Reich, it does it at a village called Hellendorf. So Hellas. Yeah. You know, is the Greek name for Greece. So it's all kind of absolutely pinpoint synchronization to convey to the world that Germany is the heir of classical Greece.
Yeah.
And they're not really very interested, obviously, in the kind of universalist dreams and ideals that Coubertin had embodied. I mean, they have to agree to let Jews compete.
Well, there's a
Jews get goals.
They do. So, and there's Jews, for example, there's a German fencer, Helene Meyer. They keep her on the team. She's Jewish. They keep her on the team and they use her as evidence that actually they're much kinder and cuddlier than their foreign critics allow. So they sort of say, oh, look, you know, we're much more tolerant than... And they do all these kinds of things. So they ban the publication of Der Stürmer, the Nazi newspaper. It's kept off the streets of Berlin. They do all this kind of manicuring of the regime.
Banned authors reappear in
exactly all this sort of stuff. And actually, there's some really fascinating books being written about the 1936 games, talking about all the American and British visitors who arrive and are completely taken in. You know, they pitch up and they say, the answers aren't as bad as they appear. You know, things are, the nightlife in the nightclubs is great. You know, even though just outside the city, people are even then, political prisoners are even then building the Sachsenhausen concentration camp.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I think Germany has just remilitarized the Rhineland. So Hitler's intentions are kind of clear. There's no doubt about the nature of the regime. But people, it's the template for people deluding themselves, using the Olympic Games to almost willfully delude themselves about the nature of the host nation. So there, I mean, they're amazing stories. This a woman who famously gives Hitler a kiss. Two American tourists, they kind of come to the games and they go in, and this woman, she's quite close to him in the stadium, and she goes over sort of spontaneously. She sees a chance just when his security guards have their backs turned, and she goes and kisses him, and the image goes around the world, and she goes back to America, and she becomes a bit, to California, I think, and she becomes a bit of a celebrity. And I've always wondered what happened to her after the war, or what point she...
Yeah, you wouldn't want that on your Facebook page, no, would you?
That is cancellation.
We're going to remove that.
That is cancellation worthy.
that would be a problem. And I guess, I mean, so the famous story is Jesse Owens.
Yeah. Wins four medals, is it four medals?
Four medal, and obviously it's black.
Yes.
And that plays very... So south of the Mason-Dixon line, no photographs of him are printed in any newspaper. But north of it, equally, you get stories like that Hitler refused to shake hands
with him. Which is not true, actually.
Which is not true.
It's weird to be correcting a story about Hitler in order to present him in a better light, but it's not true that Hitler... I mean, Hitler did express great sort of disapproval of Jesse Owens, no doubt about that.
But he's in the Riefenstahl film.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, there's no attempt to censor him out.
No, like that's right. But Hitler had been told by the organisers he would have to shake hands with... He could not pick and choose who he shook hands with. They said, basically, don't... You know, it's not really good form for the head of state to shake hands with. So unless you're going to shake hands with literally everybody, you shouldn't do it at all. So he didn't really do it at all. So it's not true that he sort of blacklisted Jesse Owens.
But it's kind of interesting, because if you think back to the role played by, the most blatant racism in the St. Louis, the games, that this is obviously still a part of American sporting culture that will then, after the war, you know, continue to play out.
Yeah, of course.
So it's an American story as well as a German story. But I mean, it's. I think the story that really sums up the role that the Berlin Olympics plays in this is that the captain, the officer who's in charge of the Olympic Village in Berlin, is Jewish, and so 3 days after the end of the Olympics, he loses his commission and he shoots himself.
Yeah.
And nobody cares, because by that point the eyes of the world are off the games. But the sense that it's been a tremendous success for Germany, that it's shown the Reich in a kind of tremendous golden light, that really does continue to resonate out. And so that's why Japan puts in the bid for the games in 1940.
Yeah, which of course never happened.
And really you're starting to see what becomes a theme after the war, that governments start to recognise that hosting the games can really redound to your credit.
Yes.
And it's really, it's the 1936 games that show that and establishes the template. Of course, the 1940 games, you know, they don't go ahead. They get cancelled. Second World War erupts, no Olympic Games, and I realise that essentially we have gone on for far too long.
We've gone on.
That this is not a sprint, that this is going to be a marathon.
We've actually proceeded at literally half the pace that we yes. that we should have done.
So we're not going to podium with this one. So perhaps we should take a break, like the Cuban marathon runner did. Have an apple or an apricot or something,
and do another podcast.
Do another podcast where we will go from the end of the Second World War up to the present day.
Brilliant. Let's do that then. So we shall see you in the next podcast for, well, Moscow, Los Angeles, London,
Munich,
you name it.
Lots to do.
All right. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.